I can barely explain how we get from there to Niagara Falls because
right.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
This is a real big fucking gun.
This ain't no ham on rap, pal.
What the hell are you doing?
Saving your life. I would have been here sooner, but I was thinking up that ham on ride line.
Hello. Hey. How's everybody doing today? It is a Tuesday once again after one week where we did it on a Wednesday and it screwed everybody's week up.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing this live in front of an audience of a bunch of people on Twitch and YouTube today. Anyway, it's Recotopia episode 44. I am Chris Atkinson.
I am Jeremy Scott.
And today's big recommend is The Long Kiss Goodnight. Mm-hmm. And happy to see all of you here. I've been seeing some comments that, like, people kind of love this movie. There's a few that may think it's maybe a little bit too out there, but I really enjoyed this back in the day, and this is my third time watching it, and I think I pick up on something new every time. Anyway,
yeah.
How you doing today, Jeremy?
I am doing quite well. I'm looking forward to the discussions today. Happy to see all the digital smiling faces in the chat. And welcome to those of you who view or listen live but do not chat, because I know there's lurkers out there somewhere.
Yeah. Do you have any small recommends for us?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I do have a small recommend. It's a pretty new movie called She Said. Let's see what the release date was. Well, it's still playing in theaters, but you can also do like I did and go on Amazon Prime and pay, I don't know, $19-$20 to see it at home in the comfort of your home. And this is a movie about the two journalists who ultimately started the snowball rolling against Harvey Weinstein, in terms of leading to him being, you know, charged and tried and I think sentenced. I'm pretty sure he's in jail. Shows you how well I paid attention. Actually, the movie's not about what happened to him afterwards. This movie reminds me a lot of Spotlight, in that there is a lot. It's almost all from the journalist's perspective. They have to be human beings because they're talking to people who have been victimized, who know that if they speak out, they might be victimized more. They're dealing with institutionalized basically abuse, and this movie is great. It stars Carey Mulligan and Zoe Kazan. Samantha Morton has a great scene, and Andre Brower's in it as like the newspaper head guy.
Nice.
And Ashley Judd plays herself. She's one of the women who went on the record for this first New York Times article. And Gwyneth Paltrow voices herself. But interestingly, there's a scene where it's a very quick scene where she's at a table and you see her from behind and she's talking to one of the journalists, but you don't hear any of that. And so I was thinking, well, they didn't really get Gwyneth. But then I looked at the credits later and she does her own voice on the phone call in the movie. But then you have people like Rose McGowan, who does not play herself, does not appear in this film, and I don't think cooperated with this New York Times investigation ultimately. And it's just really well acted, really well paced. There is just enough of each of these ladies' home life that we get to, they're humanized. They're not just, you know, reporters on the job, always kicking ass. Like one, Carey Mulligan's pregnant and then she has a baby. And then she's got postpartum depression at one point. And then Zoe Kazan has to go to England to do a couple of interviews and is video chatting with her young daughter who casually asks if her mom is writing about rape. And then she's like, I've never heard you use that word before. That's not a word that I would have thought you heard. And then she ends up breaking down after the call. just really, really well made. I think this would make an excellent double feature with Spotlight. It is in movie theaters right now or on Amazon. There's a moment in this movie, surprisingly for me, that I teared up. It was just that well paced and put together that there's this moment of relief, and I felt it, and I had tears. Two thumbs up. Really, really like this movie.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about this. I want to see this at some point. So yeah, I'm gonna have to make some time for that. I did my usual movie night with this group that I do every month, and I'm gonna recommend both of the movies from that movie night. It was a Christmas theme, so one of them was a classic movie from 1942 called The Man Who Came to Dinner. It is about a man who's like who does a radio program of some sort. He comes in and he's going to do his program from this wealthy family's house. He trips and falls on an icy patio or whatever. And when he's hurt on their property, he insists that he gets to stay at their house until he recovers. And so he's sitting in a wheelchair and basically just has the run of the house in this, and just telling everybody off. And this movie's one of those, it's from the 40s. So it's like one of those, like, somebody comes into a room, they get insulted, they run out, comes in, they get insulted, they run out, so on and so forth. There's not much of a story here. I mean, there's a story, but it's really mainly about, people interacting with this man played by Monty Woolley, I believe. He apparently, this was a role that he perfected on Broadway and came onto the scene and in the movie. The main story is that he's got a secretary played by Betty Davis who falls in love with a newspaper man that comes to town or comes to the house, and she wants to run off and get married with him. And, this is one of those classic 1940s things where somebody runs into somebody one time and then they're in love and want to get married by the next day. Mm-hmm. Which
sounds like me in college.
Yeah, exactly. It was the story of Jeremy's college days is what this movie should have been called. She wants to get married, and she tells her boss about it, and he's not happy. So he tries to do everything he can to sabotage it. And so he calls in this beautiful actress played by Ann Sheridan to come in and read a play that this newspaper guy has written. And he thinks that she'll be able to seduce him away from Betty Davis. And that's the basic plot that he has. But then she, Betty Davis, finds out about this and concocts a scheme to break that up. And so it's like a back and forth kind of thing there where she's trying to get back at him. And then eventually we get into a third act where, there has to be some sort of resolution to this, of course. This is a really, really fun movie. I'm telling you, this is one of those that's going to, if you like Arsenic and Old Lace and all these, His Girl Friday and all these type of movies where it's just like somebody comes in, says something really fast, and then they're off to the next thing. And that's this kind of movie. And I don't know, they don't make them like, they just really, really don't make them like this anymore. I would say, definitely go find some room for this in your holiday plans if you're watching Christmas movies.
Nice. Mm-hmm. I have never seen that movie. That is one of many.
This is way up your alley. This is like high on your list.
It was giving me kind of Arsenic and Old Lace and Frasier vibes to hear you talking about it, which is definitely right up my alley. My second small recommend is going to be a video game this week.
Ooh,
and I am what they call, I don't know what they call it. I'm a laggy gamer. I made that up. I get to games 6 to 10 months after everybody else does. Mm-hmm. So no one wants to talk about it anymore. A game came out in February of 2022 for PlayStation 4 and 5. It's called Horizon Forbidden West. And I really can't not make a joke about this being the lost Kim and Kanye baby. this is a sequel to 2017's Horizon Zero Dawn. This is a post-apocalyptic future in what I think is the Western United States. This is hundreds, if not thousands of years into the future. Mm-hmm. And this is a third-person action explorer game. I'm not super far into it. I've played maybe 3 hours, but I have enjoyed it so much that I want to go ahead and recommend it. And basically, you start out as this girl. I guess she was in the first game. I never played the first game, so this is like my horrible boss's experience. I'm coming to the sequel first. And like, you don't have anything but a bow, and you don't even have any arrows. And so you have to, like, the first part of the game, you're going around looking for like herbs and stuff you can use for medicine. And then you're chopping down these little trees and turning them into arrows. But you can only hold so many arrows in your quiver. And then the bad guys I'm fighting are all like transformer animals. They're like some sort of machine AI hybrid sentinel thing, but some of them look like panthers and some of them look like T-Rexes and some of them look like pterodactyls. And they have weak spots on their body and they don't have a lot of them. And so basically you have to kind of get the timing down right to shoot your arrow when their weak spot is exposed to take some damage off of them. Mm-hmm. But there's not as much action yet. I imagine the game gets actionier as it goes along. I've only encountered these robot things a few times. It's much more of an exploring type game. And I would say puzzles, but not, I don't like puzzle games because puzzle games are often both repetitive and difficult. And this is not like that. This also has a setting that will just tell you what to do and where to go if you want. I don't have that turned on. So I like to go explore every area of this, you know, field that I'm in to see if there's any, you know, treasures or herbs or something. And if, there's sometimes multiple ways to go, different directions. Sometimes you can jump down to a thing. Sometimes you have to carefully climb down. It reminded me a lot of the Far Cry games in terms of gameplay. And I just really, really am enjoying it, and I wanted to share it, and maybe one or two of these people will start playing it, and we can talk on Discord about Horizon for the West.
I got a PS5 like earlier this year, and I got this game bundled with it. So you'd think I'd be like, oh man, I've played the shit out of this game, but I also bought Elden Ring on the same day.
Oh no.
And so I started at Elden Ring, and I really, really have like progressed really far in that game, but I had to stop playing it so much back in like August because of just the way the last 4 months of the year always are for me. And so like, I am still trying to finish Elden Ring, and then maybe I'll get to Horizon Forbidden West. I'm like, do I really want to do that to myself? I keep doing this where I'm like, really far in a game, and then I quit it, and then I'm like, okay, I'll start this new one up, and like, you know, before you know it, I'm gonna have like five RPGs just like they've progressed to like 85% and they're just sitting there on the hard drive the whole time.
So, yeah, that sounds like me too.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, the other half of that movie night was a movie I had not seen since it was in theaters, 1994's The Ref. This is Ted Demme making another appearance on the Small Recommends, because you recommended Beautiful Girls a couple weeks ago, I believe. Trigger alert, Kevin Spacey is in this movie. But Kevin Spacey is also playing a role that probably would inform a lot of what he would do in the 90s in this. This is straight up what he ends up doing in American Beauty and Horrible Bosses and things like that later on. This is that kind of role, although with a little bit more heart, I think. Although American Beauty, he's got some heart too, so I wouldn't say he's not like Horrible Bosses Kevin Spacey in this, but the movie is pretty simple. Dennis Leary is a thief. He goes into this house and he cracks a safe, and he's about to steal everything out of it, except there's this one ring that's got, just so happens to have a little string on it that pulls the alarm system. And it takes his picture, takes video of him and everything. And shoots him down into the basement where there's a dog waiting, all this stuff. He manages to get out of that, and but then finds out that there's a roadblock in the town and he can't get out of the town. So he is waiting by this store where it just so happens that a fighting couple, Kevin Spacey and Judy Davis, who is fucking phenomenal in this
movie, yeah.
Judy Davis goes in to the store to get some things that you see them at the beginning. They're trying to do marriage counseling, and it's obvious that they're on the last legs of this marriage. There's no way that this can be saved under what they're talking about. She cheated on him years ago, and he's still giving her shit about it, even though they're still together and everything. And he's obviously not the best person in the world. But anyway, she goes into the store. Dennis Leary kidnaps her and then tells Kevin Spacey and Judy Davis to take him to their house, and he's going to wait it out until the coast is clear. But there's a variety of characters that keep running in and out of this house. Basically, there's a Santa Claus that comes around and gives people fruitcakes, and he's getting drunker and drunker as the evening goes. There's a son they've sent to military school. By the way, J.K. Simmons shows up in this movie for a brief moment. I believe this was his first movie, maybe, J.K. Simmons.
Wow.
Their son has his own problems, obviously, having these people for parents are going to fuck you up. By the end of it, they've got a whole bunch of family coming over. And so Dennis Leary has them tied up for the most part while he tries to figure out what to do. And he's trying to call his buddy who left him at the scene when he got caught in that house. He's trying to get him to help out. And so he's just sort of biding his time and trying to figure out how to get out of the city or get out of the town. But yeah, meanwhile, there's this big, huge Christmas dinner that's going on with all this family and everything like that. And so he has to pretend to be their doctor, and they're not being held hostage the whole time. And so there's a lot of like really dark dialogue in this. It's a lot of like, you know, these people hate each other. Dennis Leary is Dennis Leariness in this. He doesn't, you know, I guess I would take that back. I think he's his Dennis Leariness in Judgment Night and Demolition Man. That's where he's most. This one is more of a role for him where he doesn't have to go off and go on a rant, okay? And all that type of stuff that he usually does. But it's really fun, man. It's a fun movie. I don't think you can find it anywhere. We watched it on YouTube, so it's on YouTube if you can find it. But I don't think you can find this like on a Blu-ray or on like streaming somewhere other than like somebody just uploaded it to YouTube. But very, very well worth watching. I hadn't seen it in forever. I think you're probably in the same boat. You had not seen this since it came out. Really funny, really good. Ted Demme was definitely a talent. I was kind of wish we could have seen what he could have, what is was going to make. He died way too early. Same thing with The Ref, good movie.
I have not seen it in probably 20 years. I remember really enjoying it, so I forgot there was a Christmas connection, so that might give me an excuse to toss it on here in the next couple weeks and see what it looks like.
Yep. All right. Well, this leads into the big recommend.
Long kiss goodnight, bitches.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Yeah. Depending on which source you use, pretty much everybody, I think, says 1996 is when this movie came out.
Yes, this came out in 96.
I might call her Sam or Samantha or Charlie or Charlene or Gina Davis. I'm just telling you right now, there's too many names for this character in this movie, and I'm not going to remember to always keep them straight. The movie opens with Gina Davis playing Samantha Kane. She's a school teacher in a small town. I think it's Pennsylvania. She's got a boyfriend. She's got an 8-year-old daughter. It's slowly explained to you through some pretty overt narration that she washed up on the beach, East Coast, pregnant and no memory. And so this little girl, Caitlin, is who she was pregnant with when she washed up on shore. And over the 8 years, she has chosen a job as a school teacher and fallen in love with this guy, Hal. but what we don't know yet, and we are soon to learn, is that she used to be a top Secret Service CIA assassin. And slowly her memory is going to start coming back to her. Now, this starts because she's in a Christmas parade as Mrs. Claus. So the moral of the story is never participate in a Christmas parade. Because if she had not, she would have been fine. but in prison is One-Eyed Jack. One-Eyed Jack is a guy that she put away and took his eye. And he sees her on TV. He's got a TV in his own cell, I guess. It's a little odd, but the TV's behind a grate. He can't get to it, but he wants to beat the TV up.
I think Christian Bale has a better view in his underground pit in Dark Knight Rises.
He does what you do when you see the person on TV who took your eye and put you in prison. He breaks out of prison. The movie yada yadas the shit out of that. Honestly, if CinemaSins ever made a video about this movie, it would be longer probably than the movie itself, because this movie is bonkers. He breaks out of prison and goes after her. And basically, she's had a car accident. She hit a deer. She broke the deer's neck. It's kind of gruesome. And that started her remembering some things. So she's in the kitchen one day and she's chopping carrots and she realizes she's a chef because she can chop carrots like crazy. And somehow being an assassin gives you excellent knife skills in the kitchen.
Yes.
But she throws a tomato up in the air and throws the knife at it and sticks it in the cupboard. And then she turns to Hal and says, "What? Chefs do that?" Later, One-Eyed Jack attacks her in her home and she kills him with her bare hands, breaking his neck, and looks at Hal again and says, "Chefs do that." When Hal is scared. Now, she has had private investigators over the years trying to help her track down her former life. And right now, she has so little money to do that, she's using Samuel Jackson's character, Mitch. And he's about probably the lowest of the low of private investigators. He spends a lot of his time scamming adulterers with his partner who plays the sex worker, and he hired homeless guys to play cops. Anyway, this guy, who should have no business cracking anything in her case, finds a suitcase that used to belong to her, and this is like God's suitcase as far as the movie's concerned. So Hal takes Caitlin, the daughter, and they're going to go off and hide, or at least not go with mommy. Mommy's going to go try and figure out who the hell she is with Sam Jackson. This is when the movie starts to get really fun. They play off each other really well. Shane Black's script is crackling. The score, in case you wondered why it was so amazing, is Alan Silvestri, who did Back to the Future, the Avengers movies, all that shit. So the score is maybe better than it deserves to be.
It is so much better than it deserves to be.
But the humor is found in all these little quirky places, like Sam Jackson not knowing the words to "I'm not talking about moving," and he thinks it's the linen. And later on, he sings this "dun dun 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 dun, don't turn off the light, bum, dun, 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 before I go to bed at night." He's just playing a really humorous character. There's a lot of great one-liners. They find a name in the suitcase. It's Brian Cox's name. Well, it's actually some other guy, but Brian Cox is playing the guy. You get my favorite line in the entire film when Brian Cox explains to his wife that the dog's licking should stop because it's either not going to get out what it's going after or it's already has gotten out. They call him. He's like a friend, right, from the old days. And he's like, "Meet me at this train station." But his phones are being tapped because now the CIA, after One-Eyed Jack broke out of prison and went after her, they figured out that she's still alive. Mm-hmm. They want to catch her because I guess she knows secrets, even though she has no memory. So there's a train station scene, but the bad guys show up first with machine guns that kill half the passengers in the train station, from what I can gather. They go out of the parking lot, and Brian Cox shows up. "Get in my car if you want to live." So they get in his car, but then they're like, "Well, I don't know if we can trust this guy either. We're gonna look in the suitcase for another name." And they go in the suitcase for another name, and they find Luke, her old boyfriend. And they go back. They go to his farm to see him, and he is so charming. And they, how could this guy possibly be evil? And they go for a walk, and I think there's hay and animals or something. And Sam Jackson is kind of watching him warily, and Brian Cox shows up and says, hey, that's not her lover. He's the target. She was supposed to kill him. And then Brian Cox is dead. All of a sudden, best character in the movie, gone. But then we get this awesome, one of the best movie torture scenes ever with the water wheel, where they impossibly tie her to a working water wheel. And the torture is they crank it underwater and bring her back up. Tell us what you know. Of course, she doesn't know anything. But then she has this mental break and remembers everything and comes up out of the water with the dead guy's gun, who was down there already, and shoots this guy. And these guys, this whole movie is full of Batman villains. Like, did you ever watch the old Batman TV show where they were like, it's James Bond too, where instead of just killing him, they're like, we're going to tie you to this table that has a saw 30 feet away from you, and over the next hour you will slowly move towards the saw, and we're gonna leave just because we don't want to witness that. Man, this movie is so all over the place. This is where this is where her old boyfriend, I can't find this guy's name,
Timothy, is it Craig Bierko?
Yeah, Craig Bierko reveals himself. He actually leaves her to die at the water wheel scene. This is the first of many times he does this. Now it's on. I can barely explain how we get from there to Niagara Falls, because
you're right.
It's so wild. There's a scene in Atlantic City, I think, where the Ham on Rye incident happens, which is funny, funny bit. But this movie is over 2 hours long, and this time through, not sure it really needs to be that long.
No.
But we do have the last 30 minutes is a set piece right out of a Die Hard film. I actually went and Googled to see if Shane Black had anything to do with Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Right.
Because there's the whole ending. Yeah. There's a bridge and a helicopter and a nighttime and the snow and
in Canada.
In Canada. Yeah. maybe he's just a big fan of that movie.
Sam Jackson, the helicopters, all that. It's like, it's Die Hard with Vengeance part two. If you can make that happen.
It really is. Everyone who needs to be is indestructible when they need to be. There's no way, Gina Davis or Sam Jackson should be alive any point on that bridge, or beyond. They've both been shot. They've both been stabbed or cut. Sam Jackson gets blown out of a window through a sign into a tree 30 feet away and falls to the ground, and within 2 seconds gets up and throws a knife into the throat of an oncoming bad guy. That's ridiculous. And I love it. There's so many one-liners in here. There's a lot of fun, interesting action. I love that Gina Davis gets to play two characters in this movie. Just a really normal, loving, caring teacher, housewife, and then this absolute kind of a jerk, badass assassin who tells her own daughter, get over it, quit being such a wimp. Which of course comes back into play later when the daughter throws it back to her. Let's hear what Chris had to say on this time through. This is, I think you said your third time through, right?
Yeah, it's my third time through. I watched this I guess it was last year, because we actually got to interview Renny Harlin. So I wanted to kind of refresh my memory on this movie, because I knew I loved it and I wanted to talk to him a little bit about it. Although perhaps because he was married to Gina Davis at the time, and maybe that gives him some bad memories. Don't think he was receptive to talking about Long Kiss Goodnight. I was kind of brought it up, and it was like, he just kind of let me talk about it a bit and then didn't say anything about it. So I was like, okay, well, we'll move on to the other thing. I wanted to talk to him mainly because of the finale, which is so over the top. You know, they've got this bomb that's set off, and man, this movie really boils itself in conspiracy theories that are really fucking scary 5 years before 9/11.
Yeah, seriously.
This was 3 years after the first World Trade Center bombing. So Shane Black is using that as a basis for this whole finale here, where the CIA is basically going to kill 4,000 people just so they can get more funding.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, man. And they've got some dead guy who's going to take the fall, and they've got, like, you know, all this stuff. So yeah, this bridge explodes at the end. It's this huge explosion where cars start raining down. And I'm like, this is Renny Harlin right here, baby. Yeah. This is Renny Harlin for sure. With that great thing where the girl says, "Don't hit the cars," and Samuel F. Jackson just looks at her for a second, like no shit. You know, one thing I wanted to go through on this, because this is such a Shane Black, and this is not even this is some of the funny exchanges that I decided to note on this one. And there's still a lot more that I'm not even going to get to, but there's the point where Charlie seduces Mitch, trying to get that, you know, photograph or whatever out of his pocket. And he's like, "What's going on?" She's like, "It's true love, you know, whatever." And he's like, "I ain't handsome, I ain't rich, and the last time I got blown, candy bars cost a nickel." That was such a great line. The part where he goes through that whole thing about how he got to jail and everything, and he's like, 8 years ago, I was an Atlanta cop. My partner and I worked this fraud case together. And so that motherfucker hated me. I forget why, but he did. Anyway, some bonds went missing from the evidence room. And when someone called internal affairs and they went searching through my closet, lo and behold, what did they find? And she's like, "The bonds, your partner put them there, huh?" He's like, nope, I did. I stole the damn things. Which is, you know, I mean, that's such a classic trope in movies, like, oh, the cop got wrongfully accused of something and he went to jail and blah, blah, blah. And we're supposed to feel this sympathy for him because he didn't really do those things. In this case, Shane Black flips it and says, you know, he did it. He did it all right. She tells him at one point, you couldn't hit a lake if you were standing at the bottom. I love that way that was put. To the point right after he gets hit in the ball, she goes, "Are you thinking what I'm thinking?" And he goes, "I hope not, because I'm thinking how much my balls hurt." Then there's like, she's like, "I'm putting my keys in my left pocket," and then that da-na-na-na-na, whatever. And there's like, "Gun in the right hand side," and whatever. And she's like, "It makes a bulge, people can see." And Mitch says, You want to stick in my pants and shoot my damn dick off? And he goes, "Now you're a sharpshooter." Everyone knows when you make an assumption, you make an ass out of you and umption. I love that. There's a point too where she says she does something, she cuts him or whatever, and says, "I distracted you first, same principle as deflowering virgins." And he goes, "What?" And he's like, "I read it in this Harold Robbins book. Guy bites her on the ear, distracts from the pain. Ever try that?" It's like, no, I suck him in the jaw and yell, "Pop goes the weasel." And there's a point at the very beginning that character played by Alan North, that Earl character, like, goes, like, he dies and never mentioned again. Like, he just like is in a car crash and I guess burns alive or whatever, and then never mentioned that dude again. This, the next scene is her cutting up carrots, and it's like, and then didn't really give a care, didn't give a shit about that dude anymore. But there's a point in there where
the news for being in a Christmas parade, but not for being in an accident where a man burned to death.
Exactly. Right. There's a point though, before the wreck or whatever, he's all drunk and everything, and goes, "How many times do you, like," and he puts his finger in his fist and everything, and goes, "What, stick our fingers inside our hands and pull them out again?" He's like, "Every chance we get." And then she goes, "Earl, do me a favor. Every few words, have some bubbles come out and say hick."
Because I'm not drunk.
that's just a small part of this. It's like the whole thing. There's some really stupid ones they throw in here too, but for the most part, you're just going to be sitting there enjoying all of this exchange between Samuel L. Jackson and Gina Davis all the way through. It's just a really fun movie, all throughout. And yes, Brian Cox, they should have found a way to make him, not die. I love the scene that she pulls the gun out of his pocket and all that during the torture scene, but it would have been nice if that was some other character she did that with, and Brian Cox was still around, because, you know, if you've seen Bourne Identity, you're going to swear up and down that Brian Cox is going to end up being exactly what they say he is in this. But But then they kill him, and it's like, okay, well, I guess we're worried more about David Morris and Craig Bierko and all that.
I do love I think that line. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
But I do love that line before we're done quoting great lines where he says, like, he's questioning the change. He's like, earlier when I first met you, you were like, oh, phooey, I burned the darn muffins. now you go into a bar and 10 minutes later, sailors come running out.
Yeah, exactly.
I love the way he says, oh, phooey.
It's fun too, like the dude that plays, was it One-Eyed Jack is his name or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, that dude's in 12 Monkeys, if you remember. He's the one that Madeline Stowe and Bruce Willis assaults that guy when he comes by the apartment, and he says something later. He's like, I just got assaulted by some coked up whore and a fucked up dentist, you know, that guy. And then David Morse, of course, is in 12 Monkeys. David Morse, of course. Yeah. This is a lot of fun, and it probably should have done better at the box office. But you know, the Rennie Harlan and Gina Davis had just come off of Cutthroat Island, and Shane Black said that, you know, it's probably because of Cutthroat Island's failures that this one didn't get as much of a push as it should have. He got $4 million for this script.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That was in 96?
That was in 1996, yeah. God. And he apparently decided to swear off big blockbusters until, I think, Iron Man 3. This is one of those great long lost movies. I think people have picked up on it over the years, and even Samuel L. Jackson apparently on a Fallon show several years ago said that Mitch was one of his favorite characters he's ever played, or if not the favorite character he's ever played. So this would, by my count, is the third time Samuel L. Jackson has shown up on Wreckatopia. We had Fresh and we had Jackie Brown.
Oh yeah.
It won't be the last either, because I know there's several others that are swimming around in my head.
600 credits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I hope everybody else in the chat enjoyed it. Looks like for the most part, you guys
looks like they did. Looks like they did. Now I'm kind of curious here what we're gonna get for our double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I mean, the very obvious one, and the one that I'm not going to go with, is The Bourne Identity. And I think this movie is somewhat based on the book that Robert Ludlum wrote, the first Bourne Identity. It has all of those same little hallmarks in it. And then there's Brian Cox is in this. I mean, how in the world? You have to think that people who cast Bourne Identity saw him in this and decided, you know, like, okay, we'll play him in this, but this time he really will be the bad guy or whatever. But I ended up on Kill Bill on this.
Ooh,
Because Uma Thurman is also a character who has amnesia, has had a child, has a daughter. Obviously there's a lot of differences. Kill Bill is more about revenge than anything. And so it's a lot about a one-on-one fights with her former, the people that she's fought with, but still the same thing. You have a female assassin, and who is driven by the need to find her daughter by the end of it, and to become a mother to her. And in this one, you know, she's got the same drive, even though she tries to deny it for a good 30 minutes in the movie. Gina Davis tries to deny her motherly instincts, but it's pretty clear when she goes to spy on them at the Christmas play or whatever, she's still got feelings for her daughter and everything. I think it's a great scene. And it also, by the way, I believe Kill Bill has a version of the Santana song She's Not There in it. And this movie has the Santana She's Not There in it, which I thought was really interesting I was like, holy shit. Wow. They both have that, huh? Interesting. Like Quentin Tarantino uses a cover. It's a real slow, like you don't know exactly what song it is at first until it gets to that she's not there, you know, and whatever. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I think Kill Bill would be a good double feature with this. That's a long double feature if you're going to put both parts in there as well. But that's what I went with.
I like it. I like it. There's a pregnancy, a daughter, amnesia, blonde hair. There's a lot of similarities to jump off from, and yet differences enough that you won't feel like you watch the same movie twice.
Mm-hmm. I like it.
Yep.
I dig it.
All right. Now is the traditional time where we talk about homework.
Yeah. Homework. Yeah. Now, typically, traditionally, we are trying to find movies that we don't think have gotten like a big push, or were they weren't big hits, but they're great and all that type of thing. But I did want to continue with a sort of a Christmas theme here. Mm. And I have decided to pick a movie that did pretty well at the box office. It was just outside of the top 10, but I don't know. I guess I see people talking about this movie every now and again, but it's for sure not in the same vein as a lot of these others that we've done, where we have something that didn't do well at the box office that has been forgotten a time. But I'm going to do Catch Me If You Can for next week.
Ooh.
I really love this movie. Now, a lot of the things that are in this movie are obviously not true, which is ironic because that's what this movie's about. Leonardo mm-hmm. DiCaprio basically fakes his way through every situation to basically steal money and defraud airlines and various other entities out there, while Tom Hanks continually tries to find him. And there's I guess there's a conversation every Christmas that happens with them. Of course, the movie ends on Christmas as mm-hmm. well. This movie is really, really good, and I can't wait to see it again. It's been a minute since I've seen it all the way through, but I remember this just being overall excellent. It's got everybody in it. There's so many like people who just before they were like famous were in here, like Amy yep. Adams, and you see Elizabeth Banks as a bank teller in this.
Jennifer Garner.
And then a great performance by Christopher Walken. I believe he was nominated for an Oscar for this. This is a lot of fun, and I think this will fit the Christmas bill. I almost went with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which would be perfect. I just think that we probably need to space out the Shane Black a little bit. Not that seeing a lot of Shane Black all in a row wouldn't be a good thing. I'm just saying, you know, he'll have a lot. I mean, I know between us, we'll do Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. We'll probably do The Nice Guys at some
yep.
point.
Yep.
I thought about doing that one, but we'll go with Catch Me If You Can.
I feel like Catch Me If You Can for me is sort of like the last great young DiCaprio performance. Mm-hmm. This is the last movie where he is young, but pulls off young, because after this, 2 years later, he makes The Aviator, and then he makes The Departed, and he's just a full-grown adult in both of those.
Yeah, yeah,
there's
yeah.
a boyishness about him in Catch Me If You Can. Gangs of New York did come the same year, but before that, it's stuff like The Beach and Man in the Iron Mask and all teenage DiCaprio stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like you break his character or his career down into two sections, and kid and adult. This is right on that line. I love Catch Me If You Can, and it's also probably, in my opinion, the most underrated John Williams score
it definitely of
his entire
is.
Career.
It's so different from everything he's ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And you will not get that theme music out of your head after you watch this. It's a great, great score.
All right. I think we have some time for questions. Before we do that, let me tell you that Catch Me If You Can is available for free on Amazon Prime. And it's available on Paramount Plus if you have a subscription. So there are a couple of options there to watch if you don't own the DVD or Blu-ray already. Let's move into some questions and see what we've got for today.
Already?
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
I have a question for Wreckatopia. I probably didn't need to read that part. I watched this video essay on the later half of Hitchcock's career. and the quality drop-offs that occurred with his final four films brought up an interesting point, as it mentioned that while Frenzy wasn't his best work, it was a return to form. Did Dicer write this question? And a good final film. But then he made Family Plot. So my question is, which director's filmography would be a lot stronger overall if certain works were omitted?
I think Francis Ford Coppola made absolutely fantastic movies in the 70s, and then he made some pretty decent to good to great movies in the 80s. But man, in 1996, he made that movie Jack with Robin Williams, and that made no sense whatsoever. Like, you look at a man's filmography, you would never think Jack would be on Francis Ford Coppola's. He would follow that up the next year with The Rainmaker, which is really good. But then after that, he's been making a lot of these like personal films. Now, honestly, I haven't watched these personal films. I had a hard time finding them when they first came out, and I haven't gone out to seek them since. But he came out with movies like Youth Without Youth and Tetro, and I remember those getting like lukewarm reviews when they came out. I just think, yeah, if you take out Jack and some of his, maybe a couple of his 80s and a couple of his last few that he made, that filmography is as solid as it gets, when you take out some of those. So yeah, that's what I ended up on. I'm sure that there's others I could have come up with, but that's the one that sort of, came to mind.
I'm going to go with somebody that, well, I'm just going to go with Brad Bird.
Okay.
And Brad Bird, I think, was mentioned during some of, I think there was at least one allegation that he was rude to women on set or something along the the same time that the lead guy from Pixar was having a bigger issue with Me Too and ended up having to leave the company. But I don't personally know that anything ever came of that. And so I hope I'm not offending anybody. But Brad Bird has only, I'm going to read you his filmography, and I'm going to leave one movie off. The Iron Giant, The Incredibles, Ratatouille, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, and The Incredibles 2. Which movie did I leave off? Tomorrowland.
Tomorrowland.
Which is almost as bad as all of those other movies are good. And there was so much intrigue and hype. And there is some interesting stuff in Tomorrowland. It's one of those movies you can kind of feel like what they were trying to do is in there somewhere. But I would pluck that one off of that filmography. Now, he has not directed since then, since Incredibles 2. That's 4 years ago. So he's not the most active director, but just in the spirit of the question, plucking one away from filmography, that felt like the best answer for me.
A few in the chat, one says Tim Burton, Jagged says Tim Burton, Everything After Big Fish is pretty bad. Yeah, Tim Burton's another one, man. He had a lot of great stuff early on, and then somewhere it turned. Is Mars Attacks like the inflection point? I don't know. This one, Jagged says Big Fish, I think that's a good one to start with too, but man, he started kind of tailing off. Mars Attacks got its charms though. I don't want to blame everything on Mars Attacks, but like that's where it feels like we started to not see as many great ones. Although Sleepy Hollow's got its fans and Sweeney Todd's got its fans, but I don't know.
Wonka and the back-to-back Alice in Wonderland movies, and I'm just over that shit.
Yeah, Nolan says Alexander Payne wants us all to forget Downsizing. That's for sure.
Downsizing had been a series. I think you could tell that story, but in a two-hour movie, it's just too much all at once.
Yeah. And Nolan also says Carpenter without the Ghosts of Mars era. Yeah, John Carpenter could do no wrong for a really long time. And then in the 90s, I don't think he's come out with a really good movie in a while. That's probably why he transferred over to doing a music career now. That's basically what he does.
But Ghost of Mars has that scene where somebody cuts their hand trying to open a can of beans or something, and then Ice Cube just goes, "Pah!"
Yes, yeah. And So there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Let's move on to another question. I think we still have time. Yes, we have time. Yes, I've consulted the clock, and we have time. What previously innocent thing has been ruined for you by a movie? I can't see or hear Boop without thinking about that scene from Barbarian anymore. I haven't seen Barbarian yet, but
I don't have like anything like that. Steeler's wheel stuck in the middle of with you is something you can't hear without thinking of the dude's ear getting cut off in Reservoir Dogs. That's one. That's just a song. I think we've had questions before about what songs have been ruined by whatever movies, or what songs are married to that movie now, and you can't think about the song without the movie or whatever. So that Stuck in the Middle with You song is definitely one. But I also think restaurants that have depicted, like in movies that have been, that have depicted like the people in the back doing stuff to the food and then reserving it, that really is, and that happens in a lot of stuff. So you had Super Troopers that did that, Road Trip.
It's for a cop.
Waiting. Yeah, it's for a cop. Yep. And, but you have Super Troopers, Road Trip, and Waiting, and all of those where they've just done awful, awful things to the food and then serve it to the customers. And you're like, man, I guess we've all probably eaten spit before when we've gone to the fast food restaurants.
Try not to think about it.
Yeah. Just don't think about it. Just don't think about it.
I got two answers here, and they're not really either one of them things that I feel like sharing, but it's the spirit of the question. So whenever I get Chinese takeout, and it comes in a little white foldy box that has the metal holding thing, I will not eat it out of that container. I will pour it into a bowl or a plate before I eat it. And this is solely because of The Lost Boys, where he's eating out of that Chinese thing and then looks down and it's like maggots. I also have a very bad association with Peeps, the marshmallow candy
from Easter,
where I was eating some of those where I won't even tell you what it was, but something really gross happened and I ran outside and threw up. I was mocked for throwing up, by the way, but I have not eaten a Peep since. And that was like, I was 15, maybe 14. Mm-hmm. So, no Peeps for Jeremy.
It in Jedi says you can't say the word mostly in my house without quoting Newt from Aliens. Yeah, absolutely. And they mostly come out at night. Mostly. And then Jets Mets with a line of the chat probably today. Dumb and Dumber ruined hitchhiking for me. I really enjoy that one. That's really fun. I hate it when hitchhiking gets ruined for people.
Seriously. I hate when getting shot and end up, never mind. All right. I know you have let's just do this question. You have an answer for you. In High Fidelity, there's a scene where they play a CD and they bet on how many copies they will sell to people who are shopping in the store. I will now sell 5 copies of the Beta Band. The question is, have you ever bought an album you heard playing on the speakers while you were in a record store? Or maybe you were in a different kind of store. Basically, have you ever bought an album after encountering a song or two while out shopping?
No, although I've bought songs based on songs. Like, this is a weird thing, right? Like, I used to go to album stores all the time back when they were Vogue and popular and whatever.
Yeah.
And they existed. I don't remember ever going into the store and hearing something over the speakers and going, yeah, I gotta buy that. I usually went in with a purpose and it's like, I want to come in and I want to buy that Fine Young Cannibals cassette. But I have bought songs before, and I remember once being in a Best Buy and somebody was trying out some sort of stereo in Best Buy, and the Charlie XCX song called Famous came on. And I was like, man, I really like this fucking song. What is this? And I Shazammed it. I was like, oh, it's Charlie XCX. I guess I'm going to have to download Charlie XCX on my fucking phone then. Because here it goes. I'm going to have that song on repeat now. And I've heard many a song like on movie credits and stuff like that that I've downloaded. But like, I've never bought a whole album based on that. So
we went to that music festival where Bad Ronald was at. And I bought One band that we saw was Butterfly Jones, and I'd never heard of them, even though the lead singer was from the band Dada. And I bought that album just because of that concert. In spirit of the question, the answer is yes. Back in the early aughts, Nashville still had a Tower Records over on West End. And for you young people, you may never know the joys of Tower Records, and that makes me sad. But if you watch Empire Records, it's a little like that, only not the activities, more the place.
Right.
And they put in an album by Keane, and it was new at the time. Hopes and Fears is the name of the album. And I had a run in the early aughts of really being into these melodic UK bands that, because I fell off of Radiohead once feedback became more important to them than melodies. And I'm not ripping on that. I understand that a great many people enjoy what Radiohead has been doing for the last 15 years. But somewhere around OK Computer and Kid A, they kind of lost me, because what hooked me on them in the beginning was all their harmonies and their singable songs and melodies. And so it was Travis was another band like this. Why Does Always Rain on Me? I was really into them. Yep. And then I heard this Keane album, Somewhere Only We Know, is the probably the main song you might have heard from that album. And by the time that song was done, I had already asked what that was that was playing and had that CD in my hand. And I stayed in the store for 20 more minutes to keep listening to make sure I wasn't making a bad investment. But after three or four more songs, I decided to buy that thing.
Is The Lovers Are Losing on that album?
I just looked it up. No, that is not on that album.
That's my favorite Keane song. I think that was like an album or two after that first one. I think
it might have been,
Because that Somewhere we know is at the time when The Fray and all them were big too. And then like what, Snow Patrol? Did you ever get into those?
Yeah.
So,
what do we have on the chatty chat?
Let's see. Not a lot. I don't see much, actually. Oh, Jagged says, I downloaded the Rubber Band Man song featured in the Avengers Infinity War the next day.
It's a great song.
Let's see. And it says, they started playing Incubus in a store Chris was in once, and he got it going so much that the place had to close. I don't know if they're talking about me, but...
sounds likely.
But it sounds like something I would do. I'd close down a store because of Incubus playing. Yeah, somebody says Verve Pipe, and not much other than, you know, there's some people were talking about the FYEs that were in New York City. I think I've been into a couple of FYEs in my day. We had Turtles and Camelot and stuff like that out here at Tower Records, obviously. Anyway,
jam. Well, I think that's probably going to do it for today.
Yeah, that's going to do it for today. Next week is Catch Me If You Can to do some more Christmas movies, and I think this is this will be a lot of fun to talk about next week. But thank you guys in chat for once again coming out and tolerating us on the live stream. Anyway, we will see you next week.
Thanks, everybody.
See ya.
You're our friends.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Always forget the camera. I don't know why I'm talking like
the newest movie that I had, recent release, new movie, whatever, because, you know, I saw all the Dirty Harry movies.
Right.
But the most recent new release I saw was last night. I bought Fall on Blu-ray, and I decided to watch that last night. And
oh, is that the one where the girls climb the tower?
Yeah.
Oh, and I want to see this, but I don't want to see this.
Yeah, there's a lot of nope in this.
Yeah.
There's a lot of nope.
But I've heard good things.
I think there's a lot good here, probably more good than bad, but there's a lot of stuff in here that I'm like, man, I saw this in that other movie, and I saw this in that other movie. Like, I don't know what it is. Like, I can't rattle off a whole bunch of, like, people go do dangerous shit and you know, type of movies all to, but it's almost like you can write the dialogue in your head before it even happens in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like the very beginning of the movie, like there's this couple, they're married couple, and they're climbing up this mountain, and then there's this other girl climbing who's just above them. And I'm like, what, at some point, you know, you just in, it just feels like it's echoing in your head already that she's going to be the one that says, come on up, it's good, bitches. And somebody's always got to say, it's all right, let's do this, bitches, or something like that. And that's exactly what she says at some point. And I also knew right at the beginning of this, and I don't know how much you want me to spoil.
I'm not going to watch it anytime soon.
I was like, as soon as I saw the single girl with no boyfriend, I was like, oh, she's fucking the husband. I bet she's fucking the husband, isn't she?
Yeah.
Because every time they set up that three-way, like there's three friends and two of them are married, the other one's always been fucking the other.
Yeah.
It always happens.
Yeah.
And sure enough, later on in the movie, you find out that's what happened. And there's also, I don't think you ever saw 47 Meters Down, but there's a plot twist that is ripped right out of 47 Meters Down on this.
There's a shark up on the top of the tower.
There's a shark on the top of the tower. The way they shot this was really cool. I mean, obviously they're not up that high, but they shot it practically so that it looked like that they were. And, you know, a lot of just breathtaking kind of views and like, oh my God, your stomach churning kind of views. And I like how they try to solve the problems with the things that they have at hand to try to get down. So there's a lot of cool things in it, and the girls are really pretty. So, but yeah. And also the girl who takes her friend to the tower, she's like some YouTuber or whatever, and she acts differently, quote unquote, when she's on the YouTube stream, and she's kind of an asshole, or, you know, like kind of just, this isn't her type of stuff and everything. And it's kind of obnoxious. Like, you know, like in every movie, it seems like when they put a YouTuber in, they're the most obnoxious people ever. There's never like anybody who's like, you know, really good at this and they respect what they do and all that, you know, it's always got to be like, oh, look at this, look at her being all just showing out and shit like that. It's like, yeah. Can't they just be good at what they do?
There's a certain amount of like assumption of assholery in the tag of YouTuber or especially influencer. I don't think I've ever seen an influencer in a movie that wasn't a total fucker.
Right. Right, exactly.
So it's just a stereotype that they haven't broken free from yet, I suppose, which is sad because there have been YouTubers like CPG Gray or CGP Gray or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
Or Vsauce, like all these really positive, outstanding creators on the platform that have been there since the beginning, but it's the PewDiePies and the Paul Brothers and all of the more lightning rod CinemaSins.
exactly.
That tip the public perception to the negative. Oh, well. Yeah. What are you going to do? Hopefully I'll be alive when the day comes where YouTuber is not a put down. Just like I'm sure rock and roller in the 70s, like if you were like, oh, I'm going to be a rock star, I'm sure everybody thought you were an asshole. But we've come to respect that. Even video game players. Like, I still think, like, professional video game player probably comes with a bit of scorn from the general public. But one day, what I don't think a lot of people realize, and I don't pay attention to it much, but I see enough headlines, there's a huge competitive gaming scene for more than one game where tens of thousands of people are tuning in to watch. And I have tried to watch, like, League of Legends is the one I tried to watch a competitive think, I can't even understand what the fuck is happening on that screen.
I don't either. I have a hard time understanding.
And people go, "Whoa!"
What they're doing.
And cheer.
Look at what he's doing. And I'm looking at the screen and I'm like, I don't
know. What is he doing? Spell number 82? I don't know. But I did see a one-on-one fighting game, competitive match between a newcomer and like the king of all this game. And the king guy got the newcomer down to literally one more hit and he's dead. And the king guy had his whole bar and newcomer dude won.
Beat
his ass and never took another hit. And it was amazing.
Wow.
Some of these like League of Legends and some of the other ones, I think I have to understand the game before I can really get into like watching people play it. But if there was a Grand Theft Auto one, I could watch that. Even the war games where it's like, check out this amazing sniper kill, and it's over in 5 seconds, and I don't know what happened because I don't know, since I don't play the game, that there's always a dude in that crane half a mile away, and you just killed him. All I saw was your scope, and you fired a shot, and everybody's cheering. Oh, good. There's a post here that doesn't like Wreckatopia, but they like the Sincast. Oh, this is fun. I shouldn't have read this. I made a fried bologna sandwich on Sunday that I put on Twitter, and it was rad.
Yeah.
I have this little frying pan that has three perfect circles in it for crack an egg in there, and it makes a perfect circle egg for a sandwich. And I fried some bologna up, which basically tastes like hot dogs once you do that. And I put some mayonnaise and melted American cheese on top. And it was 10 times better than I hoped it would be.
Ooh,
I'm going to make it again because my brother's coming to pick up his kid in a couple of days, and I'm going to make it again for him. I just wanted to throw that out there. Fried bologna, cheese, egg. It's good stuff. Not probably very good for me, but it's good stuff. I posted on the CinemaSins one last night. I am totally open to discourse, criticism, and change, and then I marked it so that nobody could respond. Oh, I was pretty proud of that one.
Oh, that's amazing.
A handful of people have given us kudos for it.